we want to thank Lena and Richard for a great presentation today. We're going to go ahead and move into the Q&A portion of our seminar. Just so everyone knows, there are about 100 people online, and we have about 40 here in the room. So there's a lot of questions, I'm sure, coming in. We'll start with one question in the room and then switch to the webinar. And for anyone who has to leave early, the presentation was recorded, and we will be sending out an email within the next week with the link to that recording and the presentation slides and some additional resources. So we'll start with here in the room. I'm going to ask that you say your name and your organization, okay?
Hi, I'm Tom Shaw from CRS. I have two questions, one for each of you. For Lena, are you aware of the microinsurance venture incubator that was launched in January and whether you would be interested in learning more about it? It brings together a lot of the players to get the back-end side right for all of this. And to Richard, my question to you is, do you actually have a curriculum around the financial education dealing specifically with the crop insurance that you're delivering now? And if so, is it available?
Richard and I were laughing or musing or whatever about the proliferation of platforms and whatnot on this topic. We often try to attend these meetings and be involved in these things, and it's becoming somewhat burdensome. So no, I don't know about the microinsurance incubator. If you have information, please send it on. There are increasing numbers of platforms and fora and whatever, and we are working to try to coordinate some of the major ones. And so it would be good to, let me just leave it there. Please forward that on.
We've got different approaches in different countries. Happy to share what we have. Just if you give me your email, Tom, afterwards, then we can. Maybe just to add to Lena's comment, there's been an explosion of interest on microinsurance, especially agricultural microinsurance, recently, and there's been a big focus on global level coordination and learning, and I think that's important. But there's a couple of things that I think that are really key for us as a community to focus on. The first is there's enough experience that's been generated over the last 10, 15 years on agricultural microinsurance, especially on index insurance, that we don't need to go and pilot it to see if it can be done. Mm. It can be done. What we really need to do is focus on innovation around the roadblocks to scale. Mm-hmm. So for example, we're doing a lot of work on trying to test remote sensing technologies for index insurance because there's not enough rainfall stations out there. In any case, rainfall stations have their problems. That's nothing in this is easy. That's not easy too, but there's an example of a block. The other thing I think we really need to somehow get our heads around is we have to focus constantly on pathways to scale. Mm-hmm. And so it's great to innovate, it's great to pilot, as long as there's a clear pathway to scale. And if there isn't, we shouldn't be doing it. And scale takes time and patience. It's not a five-year project. It's not a one-year project, certainly. Our friends at Swiss Re once told me that it took Switzerland, that's a fairly sophisticated insurance market with quite a bit of capacity, 18 years, to put in place hail cover for farmers. So if it takes the Swiss 18 years to put in place a single product, I think we have to have a vision of how we test and develop products, how we innovate and how we scale up that has a similar kind of view over the long term to build a market in places that don't have the infrastructure and capacity already. And that's difficult. So, I mean, to give you a practical example, we've spent the last 4 years in Senegal trying to get it right. We have a five-year project in Senegal. So this is our last year, and we've just started to crack the code, but there's so much more work that we need to do on the technical side, on the operational side, on the policy and regulatory side, on the infrastructure side, to get to the point where instead of 1,000 farmers in Senegal or 30,000 that we'll have in Ethiopia, which is a big number, but it's not an insurance market big. An insurance market big is 1 million farmers. So to get from here to there, we've got to really focus on how to do that.
And I should say, our fort is not alone in that. For every every one of these things, every example, it takes more years than you'd imagine to actually get it off the ground.
So we had a quite an active conversation online, and I'd like to thank Fabio next to me for entertaining a many slew of questions that came our way. And we did have over 140 people online, and so I'm going to pick a couple of questions that went together. This first one comes from Thomas Buck of SSG Advisors in Burlington, Vermont. He asks, you're not mentioning the importance of consistent and effective regional climate data. Does R4 focus on improving climate data or working with partners who are? And similarly, Rod of BRAC USA asks, what can you address whether there's a list of countries that are insurance ready based on the availability of weather data?
Okay. So two questions. Are we using regional and consistent weather data and improving them? And then is there a list of data-ready countries? I think the list of data-ready countries would be very, very small, possibly zero. So we do a few things. First of all, in the initial design process, we do a lot of work looking at the relationship between current climate risk, trends in climatology, and climate change projections, and food security to determine what areas this kind of approach are most needed and likely to work in. And there, if necessary, we do some work on improving climatology. So in Senegal, we've had a big effort to improve their basic rainfall gridded data set. If there are any technical questions, we could talk about them afterwards. And that's a prerequisite in essence for doing insurance. And then we, at the local level, combine station data with remote sensing. And if there is no station data, at least in the early components of the project, then we install an automatic weather station so we can really start to calibrate the products. One of the things that's been really interesting in Ethiopia is working with Columbia University's International Research Institute for Climate and Society, the IRI. We've been able to take places that have no rainfall station data and combine limited station data with remotely sensed data to reconstruct climatology so that we can start to understand the risk, because otherwise you can't construct an index correlating precipitation or something else with loss.
Can I add something to that? Because the last word there was key. So I think it's important to underscore that it's not just climate data, it's not just rainfall data, it's you also need really good loss data. If you're going to price these products and design these products, you need to map if you're using a climate or weather index, you need to map it to the losses you're trying to protect against. When we talk about design for impact, you really need to make sure that these things closely correlate to the loss you're trying to protect against. And so you need good loss data. And some of the best products, and I think what the community is trying to move towards in many ways are, in many places, area yield products will provide much better cover for people. But you can't do area yield products without loss data. And it'll be years before you have the kind of loss data that you can effectively price against. So Yes, actually, you know, we need to incentivize better data collection. And when we think about this for the long haul kind of development agenda that Richard's talking about, anything we put in place needs to think about how it incentivizes better data collection for the long range, because that's the only way we're going to bring the price down on these insurance products.
Yeah.
Are we calling on people?
No. Miguel Robles from IFPRI. Thanks for the great presentation. Couple of questions for Richard. What's your experience in the R4 project working directly with insurance companies, reinsurance companies? And if you already have experience on what fraction of the final premium is really paid by the farmers or the final client? And that's one. So to give us an idea of how much subsidies are needed, are we talking about we need to subsidize, 50% of the final premium, 90%, 10%? So I think that's a key question to start gathering learning on that. And the second question is about I don't know if you had the experience working with reinsurers. Once you work with the reinsurers, how expensive the products, you know, become, especially if I don't want to get too technical here, but if we, you know, take the actually fair price, how, you know, much above the actually fair price we have to go, you know. I'm thinking, and this is related to Lina, in terms of scaling up, to scale up, you know, really at a large scale, where we will have to work with insurance companies and reinsurance companies because the risk capital is going to be it's going
to
be huge.
You're asking about the loading, like what's a reasonable loading to expect?
Okay, I'm happy.
A question for Martin too.
First, working with the companies and then the pricing, those are separate questions. Working with local insurance companies is a variable experience. In the sense that in some places you have specialized agricultural insurance companies. Take Senegal, there's a state insurance company, CNAAS, that Lena mentioned. And so ag insurance is their business. They don't have the specialized capacity in index insurance, so we're working with them to build that capacity, to develop products. And the government of Senegal subsidizes 50% of agricultural insurance premiums across the board in Senegal. And so that's a key policy issue for the government of Senegal, the effective use of that subsidy. In Ethiopia, there are private sector insurance companies. And you'll find this is quite common in many countries, is that there's an urban market for property, life, and casualty insurance, that local insurers have a small book, and that they are not able to carry the risk of a large covariate hazard like drought. So in other words, if I crash my car today and you're paying premiums and don't crash your car, the premiums can pay the payouts and you're going to have a sustainable insurance business. If all 100,000 of your farmers are affected by a drought at the same time, you have to pay all of them on the same day, and that requires you to have a lot more money on hand. So for them, okay, first they need reinsurance. They don't have the technical capacity, and although they may be interested in the business in the long run, it's a harder sell for them. And so we spend a lot of time working with them on index design and capacity development. And in a sense, it's a classic first mover problem. Until the market's big enough for them to really take it on, they're not going to take it on. And the only way the market will get big enough is if we help push it there. But we want the private sector to push it there. And so so we've got to find the right synergy there. Reinsurers. Well, now more reinsurers are interested in this market. They see it growing. They see potential. Asia is a big microinsurance market because of government subsidies, but Africa's not. But it's growing. So, for example, Swiss Re does about 50 agricultural microinsurance transactions a year on the continent, and they're probably the biggest. In our experience, for example, with Swiss Re, who at the moment reinsures all of our projects, we get wholesale pricing from the reinsurer, so there's no load. There's no load from the reinsurer. There is an uncertainty load in the calculation of the risk based on poor data, climate change, and other factors. So even if we do our very best to take all the data, come up with an actuarially fair price, because of the quality of the data and the uncertainty around it, there's an uncertainty load. And that's no different from us as a major commercially viable insurance program that has less than perfect data. So that's there. You do also see loading at the national level where the local insurers load. And that's fair, but actually we do most of the work. So we do the index design, we do the data collection, we do the marketing. So there's a question about what's the appropriate load for a local insurer, reflecting the fact that they're essentially writing paper, but also with the idea that you want them to get into the business as well and not just write your paper. So that's a dynamic there. The right level of subsidies, that's a very difficult question. You know, agricultural insurance in the developed world is 80% subsidized. That's a government policy decision. In Ethiopia, the price of the insurance is 100% commercially paid by the household, either in labor or in cash. 10 to 20% of the farmers who buy insurance in Ethiopia in R4 are cash-paying farmers who pay the full price, and it's expensive. The community design process has meant that we have products that pay out, let's say, every 5 years. There's two options. One's a 4 and 5, and one's a 5 and 6 payout. That's very frequent for an ag insurance product. Normally, you'd expect no more frequent than 7 years, maybe 10, or would be an appropriate pricing level. So that's expensive. You know, they pay $17 to $20 on $100 of cover. But that's what the farmers ask for, and they ask for it for a couple of reasons, we think. One is because they have limited other ways of managing their risk, and the value to them of the protection goes way beyond the straight actuarially fair price. It's about access to credit and being able to repay your loan. It's about being able to keep your kids in school. It's about knowing that you can buy seeds and fertilizer without losing your investment. That's a really interesting dynamic we see in Ethiopia. The second reason is also that they can pay in labor, and so they don't just get the insurance policy; they get the asset that they build with the labor input. So they get a double benefit. And for us, as the institution with our donors paying those premiums, we get the double benefit. We get the asset. And for us, we're doing a cost-benefit analysis, but you know, this year we pay like $350,000 in premiums in Ethiopia for about $1.5 to $2 million worth of coverage. If there was a major drought and a full payout, that would result in about $4 to $6 million of averted humanitarian response costs. $4 to $6 million in averted humanitarian response costs. So for $350,000 in premiums that builds assets and helps people improve their food security, we potentially avert $6 million worth of humanitarian response costs. So we figure that's a pretty good deal.
Because you're changing your risk exposure.
Yeah.
Basically. Can I just say one thing? Because I thought that was a great answer. But you know, it really people's ability. Price is a huge issue on these things in terms of their ability to go to scale. But it will vary depending on what kind of target population you're talking about, whether you're talking about more vulnerable populations and using this more as a safety net tool, or you're talking about more commercially oriented. And there's a big, you know, it's a continuum in between. But what I think is going to be the most interesting thing to watch in some of the places where we really will see a push towards scale, places like Kenya, is the complementarity between efforts to use insurance as a safety net and the development of the market for commercial products. Because I think there's some inherent market development. Well, there's market development that will occur when they're used, when these tools are used as a safety net product, that will make them commercially available, because it'll incentivize the offering of these products by the insurance.
Just to add there, I mean, one of the social protection function of insurance is a really, I think, important discussion. One of the things that we did in Senegal in our design on pricing is we did an analysis of the essentially the cost to protect someone's food security and livelihood. Like, how much money would you need to have paid out in a drought to protect basic food security and consumption and prevent negative coping from occurring, versus how much would you need to pay out to do that, plus make sure that you had a viable agricultural season in the next season, you know, so you could rebuy seeds and tools and other inputs. And obviously one's more expensive than the other. And since our focus was really on food security and social protection, and given the pricing difference, we chose that our base product would focus on protection and be cheaper than a more commercial model as well. And so that's the first time that I've ever seen, you know, an analysis to look at the cost and the options, and it gives you an interesting policy framework to think about how you, you know, how you spend your development dollars as a government or a donor to get what impact and where you try
where
to calibrate
the
totally instrument.
So I'm going to group a couple of questions together again. Electra asked,
Could you speak up?
Yeah, I can't hear either.
What ratio of weather station versus remote sensing do you use? And if remote sensing prevails, how do you deal with basic risk?
How do you deal with
basis risk?
Basis risk.
Well, I was waiting for that question.
Yeah. And there's another somewhat similar one around data. So what are the data issues in deciding index to use? And how difficult is it to convince farmers to pay for insurance, which is a new concept to most of them?
What was the last part of that question?
How difficult is it to convince farmers to pay for insurance, because it's a new concept to them?
I'll start with the data and...
basis risks. Okay. Okay, data, remote sensing. I mean, every place is a little different, so you really have to understand how the climate works in a place and how it relates to agriculture.
And how it relates to the losses you're trying to protect against.
Exactly, and what's possible operationally. So normally for ag microinsurance, a rule of thumb outside West Africa is that you need a weather station every 25 kilometers. In order to be able to have a decent correlation between precipitation and loss. That depends on many factors, and there's still a great deal of basis risk in weather stations. In other words, the risk that measure of the index does not actually reflect the real loss. So you could see a real drought and a real loss, and the weather station gets a lot of rain one day, so people don't get paid, or vice versa, so that the rain gauge shows that there's been a drought, but there hasn't really been a drought and there's no loss, so people get a payout despite having no loss. So dealing with that is a major issue with weather stations and remote sensing. In West Africa, the spatial variability of rainfall means that you need a weather station at least every 10 kilometers, and even then it's not that good. So weather stations tend, even if you have them, not to be great. So we've, in almost all of our products, relied on remotely sensed data. And that's one of the reasons why the continuous improvement in the index is really important, and we use weather stations really to validate the remote sensing, to improve the quality of it, because most remotely sensed data is actually a combination of station data and satellite data, so it's interpolated cold cloud cover rainfall data, normally if it's rainfall. And that's why the remote sensing question is really important. With remotely sensed data, your basis risk is also a major, major issue, because the resolution of the remotely sensed data is sometimes like 25-kilometer grids. So if you are in a place that has a hill or a mountain, the cloud comes over, it drops all the rain on one side and drops no rain on the other side. If your farm's on the side where it rained, you're pretty good. If your farm's on the other side, you've got a drought. And the data in the remotely sensed grid is averaged across.
Yeah.
So dealing with that is a major issue. So we've done things like combined in Ethiopia this year, rainfall data and vegetation data as a check. So you have two things working in parallel to try and make sure you get a better answer. We've started looking at things like double trigger policies, and a number of colleagues in IFOR projects have been testing that. So you use the remotely sensed data as a first trigger, so if it shows there's a drought, and you can make that a softer trigger and a bit more room for error, then you do something else, like you actually go and do a yield assessment, or you use yield data at the local level.
As a backup.
As a backup.
Yeah.
So just to make sure that there really was a loss. Obviously, explaining the complications of that technically to a farmer is a challenge. On the other hand, for us, there's one lesson from this is that farmers are very, very good risk managers. That's their day in, day out business. They know their seasons, they know their patterns. And when you do, when you engage from the beginning with farmers in the design process, we have community index insurance design teams that work with local farmers to develop the products. You build a capacity, especially with the kind of lead farmers in a community, to understand the product over time. They're involved in fine-tuning it each year, reviewing the process each year. And so if you kind of apply what's good development practice, community engagement with insurance design, you get you get a better dialogue. And I think that's really important. That said, as we scale up, you're going to reach millions of farmers, then financial education, product education has to be part of it. And there's lots of interesting experiences there. For example, in Kenya, there's a very interesting livestock index insurance program supported by ILRI and USAID.
It started as an I4
project. And there they have all kinds of things, movies, cartoons, plays at the community level where people act out the insurance process. I know that sounds an exciting play. I know I certainly would love to. But that kind of more creative product education, I think, is a really interesting avenue.
I'm so glad you're here. I don't have to do it. You're much more articulate
than I
am
answer.
On this. But I just want to add, so remotely sensed cloud cover estimations of rainfall are just one type of satellite data that are being used. People are really, including your work in Senegal on the looking at different indices and comparing them. A lot of people are doing work to try to push the frontier on the types of indices that can be used. And especially in the area of satellite data, so NDVI, the insurance, the Richard just mentioned, the livestock insurance product in northern Kenya is actually an NDVI product. People are working on evapotranspiration and other kinds of data. There's lots of data out there, satellite data that can be used. Again, I want to underscore the importance of picking the right type of index, right? It's not that NDVI is better than rainfall. In some places it will be, in other places it won't be, right? So it really is about picking the right index for the right context, and that means the topography, the soils, the crop. It's really about testing out the index against the losses you're trying to protect against. And then the other thing is this idea of doing different types of design, I think, is really critical. And in that area, I think we do have more work to do really innovating on design.
All right. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today's seminar. I know there were a lot of questions left and the really great conversation, so I want to thank Richard and Lena for joining us today and answering. They'll stick around a little more time in the room to hopefully talk to some of you. And for those online, we have your questions, so thank you. Just to let everyone know, we do have some upcoming events. Our next MicroLink seminar is going to be on May 19th, I apologize, and that is going to be on SME development and impact evaluation, so we hope to see you there. The next Ag Sector Council is going to be on May 20th, and that's on mycotoxins. And then we also have a special SEEP webinar on May 14th. This is going to be from LEO, and they're going to look at evidence review on wage labor. All of that's going to be available on the MicroLink site and the AgriLink site as a web advertised on those sites. So we look forward to seeing y'all at those events. So thank you again.